You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Welcome, everyone. You're listening to another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I am your host, Doug Thorpe, and today I have Ms. Martine Kalaw. She is an expert on diversity and inclusion, and I was very excited when I met Martine and we did our little pre-show workup. She has done some phenomenal things, has some great thoughts in this area, and it is a hot topic. I really encourage you to hang with us as we get through this material today. So, Martine, welcome.
Thank you so much, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I do want to kind of lead off with the idea. You want to kind of prop up your book again? She is an author. She's written The ABCs of Diversity. And all that information for that book is going to be in the show notes here, so you'll be able to get a link to that. But Martine, let's start with, tell us how you got into this space.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a boutique company that I started about 5 years ago, really focusing on manager development, because my background is in learning and development. And, I've spent 10 years building out learning development departments. And I decided to shift it a little bit, right? So 2 years into my business, I decided to shift the focus to be specifically for diversity, equity, and inclusion, given everything that was going on in the country. I had done a lot of work with diversity training, leading unconscious bias training in my career. So immediately, a lot of my past clients started reaching out to me saying, hey, you know, we really need your help in this space. Can you come into our company or our organization and help us navigate in this space and navigate the conversation? So immediately, it became apparent that this was the focus, needed to be the focus of my organization and my business. And also because I've worked in the human resources capacity. So it also became apparent to me that the group that usually gets tagged or, they're told or voluntold to lead diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in the organization are usually human resources professionals who are bogged down with work already. And then this just becomes sometimes burdensome because they don't have the experience all the time, the expertise or the time. So it became apparent to me that, one, I wanted to support them. Two, I also wanted to support managers, right? And continue that manager development program and training that I was doing, but embed diversity, equity, and inclusion into it.
So, boy, I've got 100 questions that were in my mind right now. When a company raises their hand and says, we want to do more in this space, what do you find is the normal starting point for?
Right. So I will mention, Doug, what I've observed is the typical starting point, and then I'll share what I recommend as the starting point. So usually, organizations, they are responding to, historically in the last couple of years, responding to what was going on socially and also responding to their employees, right? The employees were in the middle of this great resignation. Employees are demanding certain things. They're questioning the social responsibility of their organization. So a lot of companies are quick to, okay, let's take on DEI, and it's a bunch of programs. Let's do this. Let's give money here to this charity. Let's come up with this program. Let's develop this employee resource group, and boom, we've got a bunch of programs. And I think that's, I think for a lot of organizations, their heart is in the right place, but it's hard to scale those programs. And again, if you've got one or two people who's responsible to, maintaining these types of programs on top of their other job, again, human resources professionals, it's really difficult to make DEI important and a priority. So the way that where I think we should start, organizations start, should start when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion is identify what's the return on investment, right? The reason we need DEI is because we have, organizations have opportunity to widen their network of individuals, bring in top quality individuals that they wouldn't necessarily look at, pools of candidates that they wouldn't consider. Why? Because we want the right people so that we can affect business, the bottom line. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And so let's start by identifying how will DEI impact us in a pot of positive light with our business, with our customers, with our markets. Start there, run the metrics to see where we are, what the baseline is, an audit, if you will. And then we go from there with strategy and then programs.
Yeah. I think that is interesting. And I'm reminded of some anecdotal stories that I went through in the late 2020 and early 21, kind of on the heels of the George Floyd tragedy and the rise up of the BLM movement. Companies were saying, the famous phrase I kept hearing was, let's lean into the discussion. Yes. Yeah. And I'm like,
what does that mean?
In the world does that mean?
I love what you're saying, because there's a lot of blanket statements in the space of DEI. And I think that's partly why I feel that in the work that I've done, what I've uncovered or discovered or observed is that not everyone feels like it's accessible, because we use this jargon that no one really understands, or it feels intimidating for some of us. So in that workspace where people are encouraged to lean into the discussion, everyone doesn't feel comfortable leaning in. Some people feel like they're going to be shamed or blamed. Other people feel like they're just so, you know, like this is so personal, and I can understand all the emotions that come with it. Other people are afraid of saying the wrong thing. Other people just don't know how to navigate the language. So what I like to do is remind people that DEI is this complicated ecosystem, but we don't have to use this sort of academic reference when we navigate DEI in the workplace. That's what makes it more complicated. Let's simplify it. Let's think about the foundational tools, the foundational skills we have in the workplace. Let's adjust the language so it fits our culture. We don't have to use the language that academia is using, right? If microaggressions doesn't work for you, organization A, then use whatever works for you, right? Instead of microaggressions, it's really when people are offended by something that someone says or does. That right. is essentially microaggression, right? Right. Because it ties back to something, you know, their cultural association or their, you know, their association based on whatever category that they sit in. That's another way of looking at microaggression. So I love what you're saying about like this idea of leaning in, but it's really, how do we lean in? How do we make the space for people to actually feel like DEI can be accessible and they can engage in the conversation and ask questions without offending someone because they posed the wrong question or they didn't ask it in the right way and use the wrong terminology? We get to, as organizations, create that space where we really allow each other to learn. So that's part of what can and needs to happen for us to really lean in.
Well, and I think one of the very unfortunate realities that exists is that many of our larger corporations and larger workplaces, and from a just sheer numbers standpoint, are managed by what? They're managed by a group of gentlemen that a good friend of mine calls the stale, pale males.
And you said it, not me.
I agree. And by the way, folks, I hope you will bear with us. I would like this discussion to be as transparent, as candid as we can. And I may well trip on some landmines during the process here. And those of you who know me well know that I'm incredibly transparent in how I try to communicate and operate. I try to be very sensitive to any unconscious biases that I might bring to the table, but I'm probably going to ask some questions that are going to sound pretty off the wall. But anyway, please bear with me. I'll do what I have to do at the end to apologize again if I've got to do that. But anyway, to the point of the stale pale male, I think there is a stereotype problem. And one of the issues I see with trying to be effective in shifting an entire culture at a company to be more cognizant and more proactive on the DEI front is that those leaders want to somehow categorize things so that they can understand them better. And I'm going to admit I was guilty of that in the early phases of the BLM. And I was online listening to various commentators and people. And you might be, I'll give you an example, you might be aware of the former athlete who's now a sportscaster, Emmanuel Acho. Do you know him, know of him?
Yes.
He produced a very interesting podcast for a time. I don't know that it still exists, but the title of it was Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man.
And
he had Matthew McConaughey as a guest. He had Chip and Joanna Gaines from Waco as a guest. Had some interesting guests on there, and they were talking about those tough questions. But here's an example of one that came out. And again, I'm going to stage this. I pretend I'm one of those crusty CEOs trying to get this right. So I'm asking the question, how do I properly refer to my employees of color? Is it African-American? Is that a good phrase? Is it Black person? Is it person of color? Whatever. For two episodes of Emmanuel's show and about six other references I got from other commentaries, there was no unified answer to that question.
Yeah. And you know what, Doug, I'm so glad that you're bringing this up. First of all, because I appreciate how candid this conversation is, because this is the type of, I mean, we're sort of illustrating how organizations can engage in conversations around race, around, you know, diversity, context, you know, diversity categories, right? When we navigate these conversations, people are afraid. They're afraid to say the wrong thing. They don't want to offend someone. Why? Because historically, right, we all refer back to like that one time or that last time when we said something and someone lashed out at us. And, you know, we don't want to do that again. We don't want our character to be challenged, you know, and so we're oftentimes we don't want to say the wrong thing. But I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I cannot tell you how many of my white male friends have asked me this question. Martine, you know, what's the right terminology? Should I refer to you as African-American? Should I refer to you as Black? If a person is Hispanic, are they Hispanic? Are they Latinx? You know, what do I do? And I go, you know what? We're all in the same boat, because I can assure you that I identify myself as a Black woman, but another person who has my complexion sitting next to me may not identify themselves as a Black person. They might say I'm African American or I'm Caribbean, right? And so this is a space where diversity, equity, and inclusion really means, and the way we navigate these conversations is by asking questions. Now, we've got to be we have to be willing to be gracious and graceful in allowing people to ask us questions, right? And being able to ask people questions. So really, it's a matter of asking permission to ask questions. But I understand that sometimes we just don't know. Like sometimes, you know, if you see me on the street and you're referring to me and someone says, hey, describe me, the question you're probably wondering is, do I refer to her as African-American? Do I refer to her as Black? Like, or is she African? I'm not really sure. I don't want to say the wrong thing. Chances are all of us would say the wrong thing, right? So yes, you can use whatever's that politically correct term. And right now, the politically correct term is African American. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what we get to do and acknowledge is that we all have, we get to respect how people define themselves, right? I could look at you and I could maybe assume that you're a white man, but you might say, no, I identify myself as being, right? And focus on your ethnicity, whatever your family's origins were before predating back to when they came to the U.S., migrated to the U.S., whenever that was, you might say, that's how I like to define myself. And it's not my place to challenge you. I get to respect that. But if I immediately assume based on perception that you're a white man, what I would hope you would do is not shut me down and go, how dare you? How can you just assume that, and get offended. So that's what we get to do in these spaces, right? Is be a little bit more forgiving, because these terminologies change every so often. They're so nuanced. And if we navigate this space being afraid of saying the wrong thing, we're going to end up not saying anything. And then there's no opportunity to actually learn. That's how I feel.
I think that is a big challenge, and not to beat this point to death, but I asked that question in genuine respect. I want to be accurate in my vocabulary on speaking about these things, and I want to avoid any connotation that might offend someone. The interesting thing that I've run into in my quest to kind of do my own unscientific poll about this, how to be right in this area. I actually had one young man. He was a high achiever, a high potential executive I was coaching. And I brought it up with him, and he was African American, and we started talking about that, and he said, by the way, I'm offended by that term. I didn't grow up in Africa. I have nothing to do with Africa. And I'm going, oh my God.
Exactly. Smokey Robinson, I think he was on The View a few weeks ago, and he went on and said he was offended by the African-American terminology. He's not African-American. His ancestry has been in the U.S. for eons, right? So it's going to vary from person to person. And that's what I'm highlighting in terms of all these diversity categories and the terminologies that we think we should know, and the terminologies that are, politically correct aren't necessarily correct for that individual. But we can't know that. We shouldn't be expected to know that. So we think what I do is I just ask the person, if I met you today, I would ask you, if I didn't know and I was curious, I would ask you, how do you define yourself? How would you like for me to define you? And then you get to tell me, and that's fine. And I'm not going to assume that the next person that I meet that has your complexion is going to define themselves the same way, right? Right. So they're and I think that's okay. And I think that's the fear that a lot of us have. We don't want to say the wrong thing because we don't want to be labeled as something. And then the other thing is that some of us, because unlike children, right? Children, I love the way children see, especially race, right? Children see color all the time. They just don't make any association with color. My godson, he looks at me and he calls me teeny, and he knows, he says, teeny, you're brown, right? And he can see that. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that as adults, what we've learned is that, okay, like if we say we acknowledge somebody's race or somebody's color, then maybe we're insinuating something, right? And we're insinuating that we're acknowledging or we're agreeing to something in their status and in their social hierarchy. But that doesn't have to be the case, right? So that's really part of the conversations that we can have in organizations. So it's not necessarily about being colorblind, right? Because being colorblind could be is equivalent to dismissing people of who they are, how they define themselves. It's really about not placing an association with what we see. It's just what we see is what we see, and it doesn't have a particular meaning in terms of what somebody's capable of doing or incapable of doing. It's just who, part of who they are. And then they get to tell us and define the rest of who they are.
Yeah, I like that. And I do think where the conflict comes in for leaders in companies, they spend the majority of their day solving problems and working through complex solutions. And much of that process has to do with bracketing, you're bracketing risk, you're bracketing exposure, you're bracketing cost. And that, I'm using the word bracketing, that has to do with classification of things. And so it's an embedded thought process that then you turn the page and you say, now let's talk about DEI, and that bracketing mindset comes right into play. And to me, the best conclusion I've come up with in all this is to say, that's the one page. When you turn that page, stop that. don't attack it with that bracketing classification mindset.
Well, Doug, actually, I love that you brought this up, because I actually, you know, beg to differ a little bit, because the thing that I think is part of the challenge with how DEI is presented in organizations is that it's only presented as the right thing to do, right? It's almost like the equivalent of, hey, like, this is the charity work we're doing. This is the nice, you know, the you know, this is the charity work we're doing. And you think about, like, when we think about charity, it's never in terms of organizations, it's never the top priority, right? It's like it's somewhere down in the back of the bottom of our priority list, right? So when DEI is presented as solely the right thing to do, then it feels like, okay, it's a soft skill, it's an extracurricular activity, it's about feelings, and it's not seen as a business imperative. That's why I, you know, started off this conversation by saying the first thing that organizations get to do when they're introducing DEI is identifying, how is it really going to quantitatively affect our business? If we're able to tap into these untapped markets because, you know, we're really thinking about diversity and diversifying our markets, how's that going to increase our market share, right? And then we get to work our way backwards. Because when we're able to do that, then all of the stakeholders involved, whether it's the board, whether it's the C-suite, whomever, we're all speaking a common language that we're familiar with, which is business. And then from there, then we can start to get into the soft skills, the emotional intelligence, right? The feelings, the psychology of DEI, right? That's part of it. But if it's the only thing, then it is hard. I can understand why people have a hard time grasping it and seeing, what does this have to do with me? And how is this going to, you know, what does it have to do with the business? And where is it in terms of priority? It's not going to be a priority. So that's really what, you know, how I feel about how DEI can be presented.
I like that. Yeah, that does make sense. And Martine, it's hard to believe we're already up on the halfway point. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to get right back in after this message.
This program is being brought to you by Headway Exec, leadership coaching and business advisory services. Visit us on the web at headwayexec.com. Now, enjoy the rest of this episode.
All right, everyone, we're back, and I am visiting with Ms. Martine Kalaw, and we've had a very interesting first half discussion about the current focus on being able to address DEI in your workplace at your company. And she had an interesting comment as we got to the break and talking about how DEI needs to be looked at in the context of return on investment and the impact it can have on the bottom line for the company, which I do think is fresh and interesting compared to many of the discussions I've been aware of. people are tending, or at least the ones I've seen, they have tended to treat DEI like it's, Martine, you use the word charity. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far with it, but I get the drift. I get the point. It's like some kind of one-off need. And in the spirit of doing the right thing, they create these initiatives. But I like your thought. Maybe they're missing the significant positive impact it could have on the business. So talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about, we think about other business structures, if, you know, security, let's say security is a big, you know, usually it's a big initiative within companies like data security. And there's a lot of, you know, when data security is presented as a business structure in an organization, you think about, well, what's the impact of having data security? And then there's strategy around it, you know, and we're able to actually quantify what's the cost of investing in the right data security systems. What's the benefit? And so we're able to actually, and then define our baseline. What are we trying to do? What's our target goal? And we're running metrics, right? And then we're using the right systems and tools to actually roll out data security. But what happens with DEI is that, yeah, it's seen as like this soft skill, this, you know, the right thing to do, you know, but it's not seen as a business structure. And so the people or the person that's usually responsible for rolling it out, human resources, is kind of set up to fail because that person doesn't have the right resources. You know, I see organizations running in DEI metrics, they're not always using the right tools. There are actual tools and systems that are specifically designed to run DEI metrics. But what some organizations do is they'll use a human resources HRIS system and try to sort of finagle it to run the metrics, right? There, again, I talked about earlier, then we're quick to go directly to programming, right? Without actually coming up with a strategy. With all other business systems, we have a strategy first, right? We lay out what the strategy is. We have the system to run the metrics, and then we roll out the programs. So when we do it in this way, all of the stakeholders involved understand why this is important, why it's impactful. And so it does become quantifiable. And I think the reason that many of us or organizationally are apprehensive about acknowledging that there can be a return on investment is because they feel we're afraid that we're cheapening DEI. So that's why I like to be able to just, I give permission for my, like the clients that I work with, I give them permission. I go, it's okay to acknowledge that DEI can be the right thing to do. And it can also have a financial benefit for the organization. It's okay for both of those things to live simultaneously in this space. So that's really, you know, the direction that I think organizations can go as far as DEI is concerned, so that we can actually see a change. Because the way that we've been doing it, right, diversity and inclusion has been around for decades. This is not new. It's not a new concept. But we are not where we want to be organizationally. So perhaps it's time to revisit the model and create a new model of how we're rolling it out across our organizations.
I'm kind of going to take a step ahead here. So let's say, you know, I'm CEO of a company and I've done a reasonably good job of implementing DEI the way you're describing it.
Yeah.
How can that show up to affect my appeal to the job market so that young, new talent wants to come to work for me because my DEI is better than the guy next door? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I love that. I think there are a couple of ways. I would say it's not even just your appeal that's driving people to apply, but because of the DEI efforts that you're taking and the strategy, you're actually creating a pipeline where you're tapping into these networks that we weren't even tapping into before. Your recruitment, you know, whether it's an internship program, you're looking at interns from all these different schools and universities that you may not have considered before. When you're looking at particular jobs and positions, you're looking at individuals with a different background than you would have originally thought of, because you see the value that they can add to that particular position, right? So that's one way. Two is you're looking at, you're reevaluating something as simple as the actual job application. You're looking at it to make sure that it's not limiting in any way. Because what one of the things we know, studies show, is that, you know, white men have a tendency are more likely to apply for positions that could even be slightly out of their reach, because they know that they can grow into it. Whereas women and people of color are less likely to apply for a position unless they meet each and every criteria, right? So all of that will, you know, knowing all that knowledge, having that knowledge will influence even the job description that you promote for each position. And then lastly, of course, you know, people talk, employees talk. I mean, they use Glassdoor, they rate, you know, organizations, all of these things can influence people's likelihood of, you know, wanting to apply to your organization, because they know that, hey, in this organization, you know, there's going to be representation, there's opportunity for growth, and there's also opportunity for growth and advancement, and there's equitable practices. This organization may not be there, you know, they're still in the process, but they're taking strides. I don't think any person is looking for an organization to be at like the epitome of DEI, because I think we're all growing. But I think what people are looking for is for organizations that are being authentic in their work and not performative, right? And that they're actually looking at the metrics and they're measuring their improvement and, you know, and really care about the outcome of the work that they're doing.
Well, it's definitely a huge challenge, and it's top of mind for all of the executives that I've had the opportunity to work with in the last 2 years. Everybody is that there's definitely a heightened sense of awareness to that. Is there any way you can boil down and give us like maybe three really important steps to get started in the right direction on this?
Yes, I'm going to give away some of the steps that I share in my masterclass. The first I would say is absolutely, I mean, I'm already, you know, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I cannot emphasize it enough. You know, think about and identify what's the cost of DEI. Like if you're a DEI professional or you're being invited to lead DEI, think about what the cost is going to be in terms of the systems, the resources, the people, the personnel. Secondly, what's the return on investment? What could it be? Like, okay, what is your organization? Is it a B2B? Is it a B2C? Think about, you know, if it's a B2C, it's a lot easier to think about where there are untapped markets. You can research that and figure out, are there untapped markets that we're not looking into that we could expose ourselves through if we were able to widen our network? If we're B2B, we can think about the partnerships and who are our partners serving? Who are their clientele? Who are their customers, right? Are we looking to acquire and partner up with other partners? How can we do that? How can our organization be a reflection of our markets? So that's one way to start to identify what that ROI is. The second thing we can do is start to actually look at, I would say, the cross-section or the intersection of metrics. So it's one thing to just say, hey, we're going to look at gender across the organization. And we go, okay, it's like a 40-60 split. You know, we're okay. We're not that bad. We have room to grow. But it's another to look at the cross-section of gender and age and race, right? It depends on what information, demographic information we have. But if you're looking at those three different fields, you know, the cross of all those three different fields, you get a different story, right? And then the third thing we can do differently is before we continue and build out another program, another ERG, go back and start to outline what the strategy is going to look like. How are you going to scale these things? How are you going to measure whether this is working, right? What are you going to do? Who are you going to hold accountable? Who's going to be held accountable? And how are we going to hold people accountable? Are there going to be scorecards? Are there going to be, are we going to include this in our value statement? And if we do, how do we know that people are actually buying into it, right? So those are the three things we can start to do immediately. And then, of course, I have more that I can share.
Well, you alluded to that masterclass. Tell everyone the details on that.
Yeah. So if you go to my website at martinecalow.com, you can sign up for my masterclass. My next one is April 27th. It's complimentary. It's 1 hour from 12 to 1 Eastern Standard Time. I encourage all HR professionals to join. We were going to go over the 5 steps you can take within 90 days to turn DEI around in your organization so you can take a hold of it, save time, reduce the burden, and really ensure your seat at the table as it relates to DEI.
Well, that should be a great program. And again, we'll have links to that in the show notes here, and I would encourage everybody to check it out. Martine's got a lot of good information on her website and material, and of course, the book we mentioned at the top of the show. We'll feature that again here in the close. But Martine, we're almost out of time. So give us any summary wrap-up thought you'd like to leave with us.
Yeah, the wrap-up thought is, a lot of the skills that we need to navigate diversity, equity, inclusion, we already possess, right? A lot of it is, we think about, well, how do we deal with a microaggression? How do we deal with navigating and mitigating bias? Well, we get to really think about how do we navigate in any other space? We ask people questions. We listen to people, right? We want to be fair, and we want people to have a fair experience, just like we had, or a more fair experience because we didn't have it. I mean, these are foundational things to just being a human being, being an employee in the workplace, being a manager. These are like foundational tools. So a lot of those can be implemented and exercised in the space of DEI. Forget about memorizing all the right terminology around DEI. Forget about knowing whether, I should be referred to as African American or Black. All we get to do, or what we can do, is ask questions and listen. And I will preface by saying, ask permission to ask questions, right? I think that's the one place, that's one thing we should consider doing. Is sometimes it's not the right time to ask a question, but if we position ourselves as wanting to learn and asking permission to follow up with a clarifying question so we can learn, I think it's just going to take us it's going to take us really far in this conversation and on this DEI journey.
I think that's very wise and very good words. So what I would say to those of you out there that are running teams and owning businesses, this is a subject that is very pertinent in our society. It's something that needs some work. And you've heard some great ideas today on how to go about launching the discussion and having initiatives that can really make a difference and be meaningful to your teams. So I would encourage you to, take this episode, hit the rewind button a couple of times and really absorb what Martine's been able to share with us today. So Martine, on that note, I'm going to say thank you so much for joining and sitting in here. Really appreciate it.
This was great. The time went by so fast, Doug. Thank you.
It did. And I'm almost, part of me in the back of my mind, I may be reaching out to you for an episode 2 of this. I do think it's important. And I am very genuine when I say I think it's so vital for us as a nation and a people to come together and, put aside some of this pettiness that's emerged and division that's happened. We've taken way too many steps backwards, and we've got some great opportunities to take steps forward. And that's what I hope we can do with being empowered with this kind of information.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So again, thank you so much. And folks, again, you're listening to the show Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I encourage you to share this with your friends, jump on another episode as you see fit on all your common channels. And for now, I'm going to sign off, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.